Blog Talk Radio.
It's the V-Spot. I'm your host, Dr. Vic Tater. My co-host is Bill Foster. V-Spot Radio is brought to you by Planet Vic Tater Blog Network. Get everything you need and a few things you truly do not want. Only at Planet Vic Tater. All right, we're on the air, and I obviously have not mastered the art of sound mixing yet. Neil's not here today, but I'm going to be speaking to Steve Englehart, who had legendary runs on Avengers, Captain America, Batman, too much stuff for me to even mention in 1 hour. Mr. Englehart, how are you doing?
Good, how are you?
I'm real good. I'm very happy to be able to speak to you, because, you know, I remember back when I was younger and I'd read comics. I think I read your West Coast Avengers run like 5 or 6 times.
Well, that's good to hear.
Yeah, it was one of those things. I completed the entire run, and I also read your I also found your run on Fantastic Four that didn't get to go to fruition, but I still enjoyed it.
Thank you. Yeah.
All right. How did you start writing comics?
Well, I wanted to be an artist. It was the comic book art that really most intrigued me. I mean, I liked the writing, but I wanted to be an artist and was sort of working my way up in the ranks of being an artist, and ended up, because I was in the New York area, which at the time you basically had to be if you were going to do comics, everybody who was interested in comics, was working in comics, was in New York, and so an assistant editor job opened up at Marvel, and even though that wasn't what I was interested in doing, I thought, well, what the heck, you know, it was only a summer job, it was going to be 6 weeks, and I'd get some different experience and so forth, and then at the end of 6 weeks, it kept going, and because Marvel liked to give its staffers freelance work to supplement their income, they were giving me some art stuff, but then they gave me a writing job, and I really liked the writing, and they liked the writing, and so they said, you want to do more of that? And I thought, well, it's faster than art. it is enjoyable, and you know, they offered me the Beast fairly soon in this process, and I'd always liked the Beast, and then when the Beast worked out, then they started giving me Captain America and the Defenders and the Hulk and Luke Cage and, I mean, as much as I wanted. So pretty soon I never looked back at being an artist, you know.
Okay, let me ask you about that, because I was going to bring that up because I'd read another interview, Beast was your first job. How did it come about, the ideal to give Beast his own feature in it? Was it Astonishing Tales?
Amazing Adventures.
Okay, that was the one.
Yeah, they're easy to confuse. Well, the X-Men had failed as a concept. I mean, it had been, there were like 65 issues of the X-Men originally, and at the end of it, it was being done by Roy Thomas and Neil Adams, which, you know, it's hard to get any better than that. But I think people had just sort of given up on the X-Men. Looking back on it, the X-Men launched the same time as the Avengers, and I think the X-Men then was always sort of considered a secondary book. In any event, the readers at the time didn't care about the X-Men, but, you know, no character ever dies forever in comics, and Roy Thomas, who had been writing it when it went under, came up with this idea of maybe what we should do is just break out one of them and see how that works. And it was also the time when the Marvel horror books were doing well, Dracula, but specifically Werewolf by Night. So they thought, well, we got this guy called the Beast. We could make him a little more like a werewolf, you know, make him hairier and more animalistic and see how that goes. So Jerry Conway wrote the first issue. Roy, was involved in plotting it, and Jerry wrote it. And then they turned around and said, here, new guy, here, you write this thing. You know, Marvel was publishing a lot of books in those days. And when if you were the new guy, you would start out, at the bottom of the totem pole. So a bi-monthly book about a failed character and an experimental concept was about the kind of thing that you could expect to be given. But that was fine. You know, I mean, I was happy to write The Beast and the X-Men as an adjunct. But there was a period, I mean, the interesting thing about it was that until Len Wein and Dave Cockrum came up with the new X-Men and then handed that off to Claremont and Byrne, and it became, the X-Men that we all know today, there was a period of about 5 years in there when the only person who was really sort of doing anything with the X-Men was me. They were, characters that weren't being published sort of belonged to everybody. I mean, the way the Marvel thing worked was if you were writing Captain America, then, Captain America and anybody who was associated with Captain America was kind of your responsibility. And so if somebody wanted to use the Falcon, say, in a different series, they would come and ask you, and you'd say, yeah, I mean, it was all collegial. But, that's, some characters just sort of belonged to some people in terms of allotting them. But the X-Men didn't belong to anybody because they weren't being used by anybody. So I, used them in The Beast and then sort of kept using them in The Hulk and in Captain America, wherever I could as they went forward. So I'm sort of the great unsung X-Men person, as it turns out. Anyway.
Right, because I was I was trying this weekend, but my kids were in here. I was rereading a lot of your Captain America run, and I was at the issue where Cap and Falcon ran into Banshee.
Right.
X-Men were. When you were writing Beast, you did consider it a continuation of X-Men. It wasn't like you weren't just slapping a new coat on an old character.
Not really. No, it was Hank McCoy. It was he had mutated. What Roy and Jerry had set up was that he had mutated. He'd become hairier, and so instead of being a normal looking guy, I mean, the original Beast looked like a human person. He just had very large hands and feet, but he always talked very intelligently. And so once he became the hairy Beast, which again, we all know today, he was supposed to have been the same guy who got mutated. And so I wrote him as the same guy. I liked writing the intelligent speech. We didn't refer a lot to it wasn't direct continuity out of any existing series. Every once in a while I'd refer to something that had happened in the X-Men back in the day. So there was a sense that it was kind of a new, like turning a new page on this guy, but it was definitely the same guy. And the X-Men, the same X-Men, he did interact with Professor X and the Angel and the rest of them during the course of his series.
Okay, now this series is also it made Patsy Walker part of the main Marvel universe.
Right.
Where did you get that idea?
Well, I got that idea from Stan actually. When Reed and Sue got married in FF Annual number 3 or 4, one of those. But they did. When Reed and Sue got married, that was a big deal in the young Marvel universe. And so at the end of it, they come out of their church or wherever they got married, and there's a crowd of, New Yorkers all being excited about this great event. And in the crowd were Patsy and Hetty, who were the stars of, Marvel's romance line. And it was just a one-panel thing. Kirby was probably having a good time, threw this in. It might have been Kirby's idea. It probably was Kirby's idea rather than Stan's idea. But, that had happened. I was, when I was writing The Beast, I was looking to expand you know, I mean, it's one thing to say, okay, let's put hair on him and start him over again, but then you still have to do something with him. And I was looking to expand the cast of characters, and I thought about this, and I thought, well, you know, this is a very obscure book over here. I mean, the Beast is. And so putting an even more obscure character like Patsy Walker, who was, I guess, well-known to many young women of America, but not at all well-known to the superhero readers of America, throwing her in would be kind of an interesting nod to continuity. I always liked continuity, so I thought that would be kind of cool. But I also, you know, I did see the idea somewhere. I'm not actually sure, but I think that it had been done before me, not in that one panel of the Fantastic Four, but somewhere along the line, it seemed as if Patsy had said, gee, I wish I could be a superhero. There might have been like a romance story or something in which she dreamed about being a superhero. I don't remember, but I liked the idea of a person. It was kind of, you know, if you remember the series Marvels, which was about like what were the normal people doing when all this stuff was going on. That was, I mean, you know, I'm not saying that Marvels came from that, but it was a similar idea. It was like, well, okay, so we've got a universe full of superheroes now in the Marvel universe, but here's this woman who exists in the universe, but she's not a superhero, and it would be interesting to see how she, you know, if she were thrown into that world, how she would relate to that and what would become of that. So all that was kind of in play. It was basically, but I mean, the reason all that was in play was because, you know, I had just been handed the keys to a car in the Marvel Universe, and I was having a great time driving it, you know? I mean, it was like, as I say, I didn't really start out to be a writer, but here was my chance to work in the Marvel Universe and do stuff with characters that existed before I got there, so I was just, it was a bi-monthly book. It was only one story every 60 days, but I was thinking of all these amazing things that I could do with it. And so that was one of them.
All right. Now, were you writing Captain America before you wrote Avengers?
Yes. The Beast, they, again, you know, everybody sort of liked the Beast right from the start. Not well enough to make it sell. I mean, it got canceled after six issues. But, you know, Roy liked what I was doing. There was a lot of good feedback from the people who were actually reading it. Again, I think, you know, it started out way in a hole because people didn't care about the X-Men. But people who did read the book liked it, and Roy liked it. And so, like, you know, I'd have to go back and look at my in notes from the time. But, I mean, within like a couple of months, fairly quickly, Roy gave me both Captain America and the Defenders at the same time to add to my workload. Because, again, a writer, you know, it varies, obviously, in what people can do. But, I mean, as it turned out, over time, I could write like four books a month easily, and sometimes I'd write five. So, you know, adding two more books onto this bi-monthly Beast wasn't considered, you know, hard to do by anybody. And I, again, you know, it's like now I get to drive two more cars. So I was excited about the whole thing. Defenders was bi-monthly too, but Captain America was monthly. But again, Captain America was in danger of cancellation at that point. It was really another failed book. It was a book that was following the trend of the X-Men of being, you know, not cutting it. The problem being that this was the 70s. It was Vietnam War time. There was a lot of anti-war and thus anti-America feeling among, you know, the young people of the day who were basically the audience for Marvel Comics. And so people were shying away from a guy who wore a flag on his chest. And then, so when they gave it to me, they said, you know, this book is either going to go bi-monthly or it's going to get canceled because it's not going anywhere. See what you can do with it. Again, new guy, you know, here, have a low-level book and see what you can do with it. And again, you know, in the same way that it's hard to believe that the X-Men once failed, it's probably hard to believe that Captain America was facing that kind of problem, but he was. So, again, I think a lot of, you know, my early stuff, not the Defenders so much, but I mean, Beast and Captain America definitely were like things, you know, these books aren't working. Nobody who is anybody who has had a shot at them has been able to make them work. So we'll, certainly they'd be the books that we would give to the new guy and see how that goes. But I happened, you know, I mean, my great insight on Captain America was that he didn't stand for America as it was in real life at this time, i.e. fighting a war in Vietnam that was wildly unpopular, but he stood for American ideals. He stood for, you know, the stuff that they teach us in school about what America is supposed to be, and that worked. And then, you know, so then Captain America went on and became, you know, became a big, and well, it became Marvel's number one book, which was probably the thing that, I mean, pretty much undoubtedly the thing where they said, okay, this new guy actually knows what he's doing, so then, you know, we'll give him more work and so on. I think Captain America kind of established me as a writer at that point. But, yeah, and then simultaneously The Defenders, which was a new book, so it wasn't failing or succeeding, it was just new. The great thing about that, and sorry, I'm, you know, everything connects to everything else in this story, but the artist on both of them was Sal Buscema. And Sal Buscema, right, turned out to be, you know, he's one of my favorite artists ever in comics, not simply because he drew two of my first three books, but because he was so good at it. There was nothing, you know, as I said, I was sitting there thinking of all these amazing things I could do now with every book that I had, and there was nothing that I could come up with that I couldn't tell Sal about and have it reappear drawn totally, clearly, and, you know, entertainingly on the page. I mean, Sal allowed me to, I didn't have to put any, you know, restraints on myself. There was nothing where I had to say, well, geez, I don't know if anybody can actually make this work or not. Sal just did it. And that was so refreshing. I mean, not refreshing because I wasn't being refreshed from anything, but it was so liberating as a writer to be able to go, wow, this would be really cool. Let's do this. And then he'd draw it. And then, you know, and then we'd go on to the next issue. So working with Sal Buscema was a, you know, was a major part of my becoming whatever it is that I became, you know, just because I had, you know, comics has to, it's a hybrid medium. You've got to have a writer and an artist. And if the artist can't hold up his end, then the writer's going to be hobbled and vice versa. But in, you know, in that case, everything just fell right into place. I mean, it was just, I could do whatever I wanted to, and the books did well, and so they gave me more, and then, you know, and went on from there.
Let me ask you, since you wrote Captain America and Avengers, I always had this perception that a problem with Cap's book at times is the fact that sometimes it didn't feel like his home book. You got the feeling that Avengers was Cap's real home book, because that was where he first appeared.
Yeah, I never really felt that. I mean, again, maybe because of the way I came into it. I mean, they gave me the Captain America book, and Captain America was in it, and I did have that before I got the Avengers. The Avengers followed only by a couple of months, but you know, I started with Cap in his own book and was given, you know, the marching orders that, you know, either you save this book or it's going down the toilet. So I definitely was focused on him and the Falcon, you know, and everybody else in that book. So I, you know, when I got the Avengers, you know, he was part of it, and I understood that concept, but I never thought of that as being his real book. In about the third or fourth issue of my Avengers, probably about the third, they came to me and said, because there's a thing called putting books in the drawer. Back, you know, since comics in those days, you know, they were being published monthly, most of them, and there were a lot of them. it was, you know, there was always the dreaded deadline doom, the problem that somebody would, you know, get sick and not make his deadline or whatever the deal was. And so for most books, they would do like an inventory issue, which would just sit in the drawer. And so if somebody missed an issue, they'd have, you know, a Captain America story that they could slot in. But sometimes those things sat in a drawer for a long time because people didn't screw it up. And so about my third issue of the Avengers and fifth issue of Captain America, somewhere in there, they said, here is this story that's been sitting in a drawer for much too long, and we want to use it one way or another. So use it one way or another. Either put it in Captain America or put it in the Avengers. And even though it was a Captain America story, I did put it in the Avengers because it fit in with, you know, a larger story that I could tell about the Avengers, and it didn't fit in with what I was trying to do in Captain America, which again was very clearly focused on making you understand that this guy, you know, stood for American values and had a storyline that was going somewhere. I didn't want to interrupt that. So, since I was writing both of them, as you say, I mean, I certainly saw Cap as a as an integral part of the Avengers, but I can't say that I ever thought that that was his primary book. It's interesting that it came across that way.
Well, it's not necessarily it. It probably goes back to my younger days when I was a kid with an allowance, Joe, and I was reading the main Avengers books, and I was having to say, oh, and I didn't have enough money one week, so I was having to say, okay, it's either Cap or Avengers, Joe. And I'm like, well, Avengers has Cap, Iron Man, and Thor.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So, you know, yeah, so I just kind of put passed Cap aside. This is like in the late 90s. So that's where that came from, you know, just general ideal.
Sure. Well, as you say, I mean, Cap, Iron Man, and Thor, I was writing Cap, but I wasn't writing Iron Man and Thor. And so there's the usual dance for any book like that where you, as I say, you know, Iron Man belonged to the Iron Man writer, and Thor belonged to the Thor writer, and they quasi belonged to the Avengers writer, but you definitely, if you wanted to do something with Iron Man in the Avengers, you know, you had to go to the Iron Man writer and say, here's what I want to do, is that okay? 99.9% of the time, the appropriate writer would say, sure. I mean, we were all collegial about this whole thing, and later on, there were guys who got very protective and said no to stuff. But in those days, you know, you generally go and say, well, I want to do something with Iron Man. Here's what I want to do. Is that okay? And the guy would say, well, you know, I'm in the middle of this storyline here, but we could fit it in at this point, and here's, you know, he'd be wearing this particular armor. And you go, okay, fine, and then you just go ahead. Obviously, I didn't have to do that with Captain America, but I was always aware when I was doing the Avengers, you know, it wasn't Captain America and the Avengers. It was this group of people, and so I didn't want to favor him particularly compared to the other two. But it was definitely a different kind of deal in that, you know, I had no trouble at all fitting Captain America anywhere I wanted to in the Avengers because I could negotiate it with myself. With the other two, I didn't really have any trouble, but I had to take the extra step of going and saying, well, you know, what about this and so forth. And then there would be times, you know, when the guy would say, well, you know, Thor is in outer space for the next 6 months, and I don't know how we're supposed to do that. And then the Avengers writer, whoever it would be, would have to kind of, you know, either write Thor out for 6 months or figure out some way to connect it to that outer space story, for example. It was interesting. It was interesting writing both of them, I will say that, at the same time.
All right. I want to ask you about one of the stories you did on Captain America, because it's one of those stories I read about years ago, like when I'd read the old Marvel Ages, when you brought back the 1950s Captain America.
Yeah. Well, that was... Well, when Roy Thomas gave me Captain America, he also gave me that idea. Roy, you know, as has been seen, Roy likes the 50s and the 40s. And so he said, you know, it would be, you know, we've never really explained who that guy in the 50s was. I mean, it's supposedly the guy in the 40s is the same guy as the guy we've got now, but Captain America was theoretically frozen in ice during the 50s. But we publish stories about Captain America, so how would that work? And, you know, that's all he gave me. I mean, he didn't tell me how it would work or, you know, anything beyond that. But he said it might be a good idea to start off with this 50s concept. So, you know, I took that idea and developed the story from that seed. And, again, you know, I think Roy and I shared, again, this was the early 70s, which meant Marvel was only 10 years old at that time. And Stan, who had written pretty much everything for most of that period, had really, you know, he did continuity. I mean, it was one universe and everybody lived in it and things that happened got referred to later and all that kind of stuff. Coming, you know, when you're only 10 years into that, it's not that hard to do. When you're, you know, when you're 50 years into it, it's impossible to do probably, but you know, I was able to my great delight, because I love comics and stuff, I ordered up the stats of the art from the 50s, you know, read all the 50s stories, thought about how I would make that work out, and was able to use actual 50s art in the book, as we were telling the story of the guy from the 50s. So again, it's more of that. I've been handed the keys to the car, and now the car turns out to be like a Mercedes. I mean, there's all these things that I get to play with here. So, and it also, I mean, again, the other thing, I mean, I'm sure one thing led to another, and it all sort of fit together. But since my idea was to show that Captain America stood for the kind of timeless virtues of the country, and the 50s was the notorious anti-communist Red Scare kind of thing, and in fact, that's the guy who was in the 50s. I mean, those stories from the 50s were all about Captain America fighting the commies. It made sense. I mean, using the 50s Captain America, the anti-communist guy from the 50s, sort of showed that he was not the guy who we had, who stood for sort of things that were beyond any particular era's political concerns. So everything just sort of fit together. And I often say when you're starting a new series, the first issue is like building a rock. It's the second issue where you get to start rolling the rock, meaning that, you know, in the first issue of any series, you're kind of saying, okay, here's who the hero is, here's who the villain is, here's who the girlfriend is, here's who the friend is. And you try to make that into an interesting story, but your main thing is to kind of say, here's who they are. And then with the second issue, you can start having them progress. Obviously, they can't progress in the first issue because they're just getting there. So Roy said do the 50s Captain America. I thought 50s Captain America, anti-communist versus 70s Captain America, standing for, you know, the ideals. You know, that all fit together. And then once that was in place, that was, you know, that was in a sense the rock. And so I was able to just continue from there with the idea that Captain America stood for something more than a simple political calculation at a particular period in time. And that worked, you know, as I say, that, you know, but absent any one of those particular factors, who knows how it would have turned out.
Let me ask about this, since, you know, that was one of the things you did on Avengers, because you were like, in my mind, you know, you're like one of the Avengers writers. You know, like if you were doing a Mount Rushmore, it'd be like, you know, Roy Thomas, you, and Jim Shooter. You're the one that connected Kang and Immortus, aren't you?
No, that Stan did that. I think it was Stan. I don't remember exactly where, but somewhere in the Stan issues, which were like the first dozen or something like that, first 15. But yeah, no, it had been established that Kang and Immortus were the same guy. It had also been established that they might be the same as Doctor Doom, and it had also been established that they might be the same as the Pharaoh, whose name I forget.
Ramatut.
Yes, Ramatut. So all those guys, it had been one of those little things that writers, Roy might have been involved in some of that, I'm not sure. But, I mean, all that stuff had been set up, but not, nobody pulled the trigger on it, so to
right,
speak.
I
mean,
it was. I think you went into depth on it, didn't you?
Yeah. Well, when I did the story, which is still one of my, you know, I would say one of my top five favorite personal favorites, Avengers 129 and Giant Size Avengers 2, which was really all sort of one long story. That was all the Ramatut Kang thing. And so, as I recall, I mean, it was something about, well, you know, I'm not going to get into it, but it was about, you know, traveling in time and going backward in time to become somebody who would then come forward in time, who would do, you know, this and that. And so then I made it explicit that these people were the same people and worked from there. Kang, as you know, became one of my favorite Avengers villains, and I did more with him later on. I began to see all the all the great possibilities in time travel, and played with him. But yeah, I just was picking up on stuff that had already been established at that point.
All right, and I'm sorry if I don't like just doing it like a long list. I like to kind of try to skip around to keep it interesting for everybody. When you were doing Cap, you gave him super strength, and that stuck for a while. What made you decide that he needed it, or not necessarily needed, but why did he have super strength?
Well, that again, that was Roy's idea, and it was in that era when, you know, Captain America had been not doing well for a long time. One of the things Roy did when he became editor-in-chief was look at books that weren't doing too well and figuring out a way to kind of, you know, jazz them up a little bit. He's also the guy who put black leather on the Submariner. And I remember the idea with the Submariner was without a costume, he's basically pink, and you can't have a guy who's pretty much overall pink be a hero. But as it turned out, nobody liked the black leather on the Submariner, so he went back to being pink. It was basically the same with Captain America. You know, I was doing what I was doing, but Roy still thought, you know, maybe if Captain America was stronger and could do more spectacular stuff, then that would, you know, that would also help pump up his sales numbers. So, you know, we gave him, you know, at Roy's direction in this case, I mean, we gave him the super strength. But as you may have noticed, after a while, we just sort of stopped talking about it. And, I mean, he never officially lost that super strength, but it's just like we just sort of let that one go. You know, again, as a young writer, you know, when you're new in a career, if your boss says, do this, you don't necessarily say, gee, I really would rather not. You just sort of figure out the best way to do it, and so that's what we did. But, I mean, you know, he became convinced as well that it really, people didn't like it, and the book was sort of zooming upward in sales, and it clearly wasn't because of the super strength. It was because of finding some reason for Captain America to exist, so he didn't have any trouble when I just sort of said, you know, I think we'll just kind of let that one slide away. But again, I mean, and as I say, black leather on the Submariner, the hair on the Beast, you know, all these things were ways to take existing characters and kind of, you know, jazz them up a little bit. And the hair on the Beast stuck around, but the other two didn't work.
Okay, going back to the Beast for a second, you were the one that I hope I'm right about sometimes, you know, I think the transition, I think you took over Avengers from Roy Thomas.
Yes.
Okay, you're the one who put Beast on the team, right?
Yeah, because he was I call him my firstborn. He was the guy that I started, you know, my comics career, writing career with. And again, you know, it was a marginal character in a dubious bi-monthly book, and after six that nobody wanted to read to start with, and after 6 months the sales had improved, but not enough, so they, you know, they dumped him out of Amazing Adventures and I think replaced him with Killraven, if I recall. You know, again, from that point on, the Beast, and by extension the X-Men, sort of belonged to me. I mean, they weren't appearing regularly, but if anybody wanted to use them, they would have to come and ask me about it. And, you know, fine. And as I recall, not many people did. I don't think there was too much X-Men other than what I was doing with them at that time. But you know, he just sort of stayed there, and when I finally wanted to revamp the team, and I was looking, you know, okay, so it's an Avengers tradition to revamp the team every once in a while, and now it's my turn to do that. I thought, let's, you know, I like the Beast, and he's not appearing anywhere else. So, and, you know, the X-Men still doesn't exist again. So he's not appearing anywhere, and neither do the rest of them. So, yeah, I thought, let's get him in there. And Patsy Walker, too, of course. The stuff that I was working on back in the day on the original Beast series, I still thought there were some good ideas to be had there, and here was a chance to do them in a book that was existent. So... And it's funny because a lot of people think of the Beast more as an Avenger than as an X-Men now.
Yeah, I was going to mention that it set off many wars in the late 90s.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it was just... Yeah, go ahead.
Nothing. I just remember Kurt Busiek and George Perez, they really wanted Beast on Avengers, and the X-Men wouldn't let them have him, but the X-Men weren't really doing anything with him.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. I mean, that's, you know, again, I think as things got bigger and more complex, you'd run into that a little bit more, where people, you know, where people would not be doing something with a character, but they still wouldn't let you use him because he, you know, because he was theirs, et cetera, et cetera. It wasn't like that in the beginning, but yeah, I mean, I thought, you know, I mean, I just liked him, and so putting him on the Avengers was my chance to do more stuff with him, and then the fact that the Avengers was going really well, and that, you know, and that I really liked the Beast, and so was able to do good things with him in there, you know, I still can, you know, I mean, me personally, I would consider him an X-Men before I would consider him an Avenger, but evidently I made him fit in well enough with the Avengers that a lot of people think that he belongs over there, which is kind of an interesting character bit. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, I was going to ask you about writing a team book, because I'm an amateur writer, emphasis on amateur, and, you know, I noticed when I'm trying to do a large, like a team story, how do you keep all the characters relevant with that, you know,
Well, you've got to give each of them a character and a storyline. And again, with you can't do all the storylines all the time. So it's a question in my mind of you know, like whack-a-mole, you know. It's like, okay, we'll do a Vision story now. And Captain America and Iron Man will, you know, will be part of the team and do their stuff, but they won't be, like, leading the story. But then you get done with the Vision story, so then you do a Beast story, or, you know, or you do a Captain America story. If you can. I mean, it's harder to do it, as I said, with the guys who are in their own books. But what I tried to do was make sure that everybody on the team had something to do every issue, but that, you know, but most of them would be doing they wouldn't be driving the story at all. But, I mean, you don't forget about Yellow Jacket when he's not driving the story. You still do a little Yellow Jacket bit or a little, you know, a little whoever bit, something, you know, just to say he's, you know, everybody on this team matters, and so everybody on this team is going to show up this month and do something. But the story is about, you know, about Mantis. The story is about the Wasp, whatever, you know, whatever that might be. And Neil Adams, you know, as you may know, when I was still trying to be an artist, I worked with Neil Adams. And so, you know, like anything else, when you're just getting into something, people tell you stuff, and it's the first time you've heard it, so it sticks with you. Neil used to tell me that one of the tricks he did when he drew, you know, Green Lantern and stuff like that, was he would, on the splash page, he would draw an incredibly detailed picture of what's going on. You know, I mean, all the background, all the grit, all the grime, all the perspective and all that. Then for the next six pages, he could do no backgrounds at all, and everybody would just assume that they were there. You know, I mean, you'd establish the world so completely that then you didn't have to draw it anymore, which saved you the time, but everybody felt, you know, they didn't feel like you'd left out anything. And it's kind of that same deal that, you know, if you give three panels to Yellow Jacket and the Wasp, then you don't need to do anything else with Yellow Jacket and the Wasp that month, but people, you know, people, they got their Yellow Jacket fixed. They know he was there. He hasn't been forgotten. And so it feels like everybody on the team contributed. But you can vary how much each contributes. Go ahead.
Another question I was going to ask you about writing is that I was reading another interview with you. That's actually what made me decide to contact you for the show, because it's very informative. You talked about how when you initially introduced Patsy Walker, you weren't exactly sure where it was going. You called it, I can't remember the term you used, called it throwing something in the air.
Plates, yeah. Throwing plates in the air. Yeah, I did that a lot. When you're writing that many monthly books, I at least never really liked to plot things out too far in advance, because so much of comics to me was being there in the moment. And if you, like, worked out what you were going to do for the next 6 months, then 6 months down the line, you would just be filling out the form. You'd just be, like, doing exactly what you said you were going to do. And not only would that be boring, it would seem to me, but also, inevitably, somewhere in around, you know, the third or fourth month, some new idea would come to you, and you'd go, well,
right,
that would be really interesting to run with that, except I can't because I'm locked into this longer thing. So I tended to, you know, I mean, I kind of kept, you know, an idea of where I was going to go with things, and you know, if I came to some point where I said, I really need to know how this is going to work out 3 months from now, then I'd figure that out. But in general, I tried to keep it as spontaneous as possible, and so I would be cruising along, and I would come to one of those places where I'd say, it would be really interesting, you know, going back to Patsy Walker. I mean, I didn't know what I was going to do with her, but I thought, she's an interesting character, she would fit in with this group, let's see what happens. And then, you know, the next month, it would be time to do something with Patsy Walker, because, as I just explained, she's in the book, so I got to do something with her. And so then I think, well, considering where we're at in the story, what everybody else is doing, blah, 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 what would be interesting for her to do? And so a lot of my, I mean, Mantis is the prime example of that sort of thing, where, you know, her whole storyline sort of developed because month by month I'd go, well, what would be interesting for her to do? Well, it'd be this. And so then the next month you'd go, well, she did that, so she started down this path over here. I've just been joined by my cat, who's very noisy. You're going to hear a cat here in the background here. You know, once you start down a path, once you say, okay, she's going to turn to the left here, then next month she's going to the left. So then you work off of that. And then, and so but I wouldn't, you know, getting back to the throwing plates in the air, I mean, I would just, I'd go, it would be really interesting. There's something going on here that I want to explore later. So I'll just drop a hint to it now, and when we get to later, then I'll figure out what that's going to be. And it seemed to have worked. I mean, I just, you know, I'd throw the plate up, and eventually it would come down. I would sort of have a sense of when it was going to come down. If I, you know, if I don't give you an answer to that query pretty soon, you're going to forget what I was talking about, or it's going to be boring or whatever. So this month that plate's coming down. So this month I have to, you know, figure out what it is that I threw the plate up for. You know, so much of comics writing to me was just, you know, having fun with it as I did it. You know.
All right, go forward a little bit because I'm running out of time. My nephew's here, and he's kind of running, making a mess of things. You left Marvel in the mid-70s, late-70s, and you had a run at DC. But when you came back in 19, you came back to Marvel in, was it 86, 85, or 86?
84, actually.
Okay, 84. How had things changed when you were writing West Coast Avengers compared to how it was when you were the writer on Avengers?
Well, I don't think the Marvel culture had changed. It had changed somewhat because Jim Shooter had become the editor, and Shooter was, you know, he was a different sort of editor from the guys who had preceded him. So there was somewhat, but he was... Shooter was trying to run the traditional Marvel only under his rules, which then, you know, led to various and sundry problems. But he was still trying to continue what had been there before. So the overall Marvel hadn't changed to a great extent, I don't think. It was interesting writing the West Coast Avengers instead of the Avengers. I mean, my, again, I, you know, possibly because when they gave me Captain America, they said, you have to make this succeed. I always sort of approached any book that I did as like, I'm going to make this the number one book out there. And so when I was writing West Coast Avengers, I just took it as a matter of faith that that was the real Avengers book. And the other Avengers book was not. So I wrote the West Coast Avengers with the idea of making it the you know, the premier book. And I don't know, you know, I don't know what Roger Stern or whoever else was doing it was doing, you know, what their approach was on the East Coast Avengers. But so it was a different. The Marvel ambience was not particularly different. Writing a different group of Avengers, although it did have Hawkeye and Iron Man in it, I mean, it was a quasi-different group of Avengers. That was kind of interesting. But again, you know, the Avengers did reinvent themselves all the time, and I had you know, changed the original Avengers group when I added the Beast and Hellcat and so forth. So, you know, you could look at it as just another group of Avengers. I did think that Tigra particularly was kind of maybe not quite up to Avengers caliber. I never thought, I mean, she was cute, but I never thought she was particularly, she didn't have the stature, say, of the others. But otherwise, it was just sort of coming back and doing the same thing again.
One of the things on the book that you inherited was Hank Pym, and Hank had been third quite the ringer at that point. How did you did you view it as your job to fix him?
Yeah, well, yes, I did. I mean, him and anybody else who might need fixing. I mean, that again, my idea was to make these books. See, when I was before I got there, Marvel was great. You know, I mean, as a reader, I loved reading Marvel. And one of the things I noticed was if there was a book that wasn't doing all that well, somebody would come in and give it a jolt of energy and do something with it. I mean, there were no deadbeat books, really, in the first 10 years of Marvel. There were books that did better than others and you know, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, even the lesser ones like Ant-Man and the Wasp or later Giant-Man and the Wasp, which never really did very well, they were sincere books. I mean, the story of Hank and Jan continued, and they were as much Marvel heroes as anybody else. They just somehow never really quite got to be as popular. And so when I was doing West Coast Avengers, the whole Dr. Pym thing was Mark Gruenwald, my editor's idea again. He liked Doctor Who, and he thought maybe Hank Pym, who had never, Hank had never been a top flight character. He was always a second rank guy. And yet he was just as old in Marvel time, and he was, he'd been around, and he'd been a part of everything, but he just never had become the same level as Captain America and Iron Man and Thor and all that. So when I got the West Coast Avengers, and Mark said, I want to put, Hank Pym in here as Dr. Pym, that's another one where I wasn't, like, totally sold on that idea, but again, it's another one where I had to just implement it. And so once I got him, I thought, okay, what can I do to actually make this guy, give him the stature of the rest of them? What can I do to, like, and so I took the idea that he'd never had the stature and ran with that, with him planning to commit suicide and so forth. I think anybody, any book, any character that I got my hands on, I wanted to make, like, the best version ever, to the best of my ability,
He went on to do Fantastic Four after this. This led to the end of that particular run at Marvel. Was it your ideal not to use Reed and Sue at the beginning?
Yes. Yeah, I really thought that, possibly because of my time on the Avengers, where you did get to reinvent them every once in a while, I really thought that Reed and Sue and Ben and Johnny had become stale. That, they're a beloved family, et cetera, but they never changed, and there's only so many things you can do with the four of them. I mean, you can have Ben get unhappy and leave. You can have, you can do things, but after a while, they've all been done, I thought. And so when I came onto that book didn't need fixing. It was, it was the FF, and it was doing great. But I thought, well, more stories about those four in and of themselves, how is that going to move anything forward? How is that going to be any different from what had already happened? So, yes, it was my idea. Reed and Sue had been saying for a long time that they were going to retire and take care of little Franklin. And what I really liked about the early FF was the fact that they were sort of making it up as they went along. I mean, in real life they were too. Stan and Jack were making it up as they went along. But what they really, the real charm of the early FF to me was the fact that these people, they were just people, and all of a sudden they were superheroes, and how does that work? And, they make mistakes, and they do this, they do that, they see what works. So I thought it would be really fun to have Reed and Sue disappear and have Ben become the leader, which is not his natural role, and yet he would get it because he's the highest ranking guy left, and then see him make mistakes and see how that would go. So that was my intent. And unfortunately, after I did that for a while, we got basically to the end of the Marvel Age. I mean, there came a point in like 1989 when they said, we're more interested in selling lunchboxes now. This is before the movies, obviously. But, I mean, it was like the comics are becoming an adjunct to all the merchandising we can do. And it was explained to me quite clearly that you can't very well sell a lunchbox with Reed and Sue and Ben and Johnny on it if Reed and Sue aren't in the book. Therefore, you have to put them back in the book. And that, led to my departure and in my opinion, led to that's where the Marvel Age ended, I think. I mean, after that was the era when, every title was number one and there were four Thor books and it was all... it was all about the merchandising and not about the books anymore. But that's,
All right. Okay, well, that brings up a good point. During your run is when the Thing got mutated further.
Right.
Did you have a hard time getting that put through?
No. Until the Marvel Age ended, and you know, I mean, that's how I see it. Others may see it differently, but I mean, until 89, whatever you want to say, the writer was basically the guy who ran the book. I mean, the editor could say, put Dr. Pym in there or whatever, but the editor, I don't think, ever said, oh, you can't do this kind of thing. It was pretty much up to the writer, and so I had, you know, I had a free hand on the FF up until I didn't. I thought, again, the Thing had looked like he had looked for 20 years at that point, 25 years. It might be interesting to change him up, and that came with the idea of changing Sharon Ventura into a Thing as well, and the idea that she liked it when Ben hated it, and, you know, there was plenty of story possibilities to be had in there. So, yeah, I just, the design was Rich Buckler's. I think it was Buckler's. It might have been, I forget exactly whose design it was, but, I mean, it was the artist. Again, I can't say I never did it because I might have done it once or twice, but most, you know, as far as a general rule goes, if I wanted somebody to look different, I would just say to the artist, so he looks different, you know. I might say how or whatever, but I didn't design any of these guys. So it was somebody else's idea as to what he looked like, but I was, you know, that's fine. And I liked what he looked like.
Right. I was going to mention that, though, because when I started reading comics, these are back issues that I found readily available, and I always really liked Sharon Ventura as the she was never called the She Thing, because I figure a woman would be more offended by being called that. But I always
There was already the She Hulk, and so I informally called her the She Thing. But I knew I couldn't call her the She Thing because it would just sound like a copy of the She Hulk. Yeah, I mean, because she was a beautiful woman beforehand, but she, you know, there'd been this whole rape thing, and, you know, she'd been abused, and the whole idea that, you know, I'm not a woman, but I, you know, I've heard it said by women along the line somewhere or other that, you know, sometimes they wish they didn't look as attractive as they might, because it would fend off this, that, the other thing. So I thought it would be an interesting deal for this beautiful woman to actually prefer not attracting men for a while. I mean, you know, it wasn't probably forever, but it, as it turned out, I didn't get to finish up the storyline, so who knows. But the fact that she would become Thing-like and like it and prefer it under her circumstances, I guess, as I just said, you know, I thought there was a lot of interesting stuff to be done in there.
I was thinking about what you just said just now, you know, and it reminded me when I was a kid, you know, and you'd have rough times, you know, or, you know, maybe your parents might beat you or something, you know, and I was thinking if you got older, you know, even if you looked like a freak, you know, there'd be something appealing about having that kind of power.
Yeah, yeah.
Because even if you're ugly, you're safe.
Yeah, well, I mean, she was able to hide, you know, her beauty, and at the same time gain all that power, as you say. So in many ways, I mean, you can see how she would like that, you know, and maybe not everybody would, but you could see how she would. You know, I was, again, with the FF, I was cut off in midstream. So, you know, it's hard to say. And as I explained, I really didn't have a long-term plan. I was doing it as events happened, so you know, impossible to say where I would have gone with it if I'd been able to just go. But I was looking to really make that book, you know, show you sides of Ben that you hadn't seen, show you sides of Johnny that you hadn't seen, and make it, you know, make it an interesting title, something different from what I thought had become stale.
Mr. Englehart, I'm about out of time. I wanted to thank you very much for speaking to me. I've had this was like a lot of fun and really helped me learn. Just wanted to thank you for doing the show.
Well, you're welcome. It was fun for me, too.
All right. You have a very good day. We'll be back at the end of the week. We'll be talking to Danny Fingeroff. Everybody have a good day.